Mr. Day, Reel 9. We're talking about your time as you moved up the North African coast, and particularly in Tahuna camp. Before we go on to when you were recruited as a medical orderly in the camp, by now you mentioned Ellis. Had you met some more of your old comrades from the South, not Cesar's?
No, not at all.
So you heard about Ellis later?
I met Ray Ellis later on in another camp up north of Italy.
And he told you?
About the incident of this man, Letzi, yes. There in Tahuna, I remember this, Letzi, who spoke English to some extent, he came around asking for volunteers to be intermittent as workers. And quite a lot of them replied. Obviously, the fact is, if you got a job, you lived, you had more food. I went along and I was interviewed by three doctors, one South African, Major Zillam, an English doctor named Captain McPherson, and an Italian doctor whose name I never knew. Zillam said that the fact was I wasn't in the RAMC, I obviously wasn't available for this position, I wasn't right for it. But the father said if the man's been in the medical world, he's had contact with a doctor, he may know more than the RMC. And the Italian doctor said to me in English, asking me the therapeutic value of numerous Italian drugs like aspirina, aspirin, glucagon, Ibex powders, elementary things, which of course I could reply to. And he said, that in the Italian said, he will do for me, and I'll give him the job of cleaning the room out to make it a room for inspection, medical inspection room. I then went to the market with them to Tripoli to buy supplies, extra supplies for the camp, dates and things. And that's when I started to work for as an interpreter. My Italian improved, I hope, and I started out there in Tahuna as an interpreter and a medical orderly.
So what were your duties? What would a day's duties be in Tahuna?
I had to interpret between the British prisoner of war.
Your Italian seems to have jumped suddenly, though. I mean, from almost nothing, just a few medical terms, to being an interpreter.
Yes, it did. It had to jump. I wanted a job. I was being starved like the rest of them. And if it hadn't jumped, I'd have gone back again and I'd been found myself not adequate to the job, and I'd gone back into a prison of war.
So were you acting more as an interpreter than as a medical orderly?
Both.
So what were the day's duties, as we said, be like?
Sick parade in the morning, interpreting English to Italian and Italian to English. In Italian, said to me, ask him how he feels this morning. Well, in English, I asked the man how he felt and replied to the Italian doctor, interpreted from English to Italian, to the Italian doctor, what the English lad or British boy had said to me regarding his complaint, what he'd gotten. And then, of course, they did have another ward containing Italian troops belonging to that particular camp. But most of course, Italian and Italian were okay. But the English doctor sometimes came with us, just as I mean, two doctors are better than one in the situation. Two knowledges are better than one. And I worked at Tahuna for quite some time.
And what was the sort of complaint amongst the British prisoners of war?
A lot of dysentery. Mostly it was bacillary dysentery, which was comparatively easy to cure. And a lot, there was some anemic dysentery, which was more difficult. It was diagnosed under a microscope, seeing anemic people about, and it's a pure medical terminology. It was treated by emetine.
Which is?
A drug administered in subcutaneously, a syringe.
And would that work?
That did work in a number of occasions, and quite a lot of occasions.
Would it work quickly, though?
Oh, no. It took quite a time to do. Also, these men had to have their lectins drained out by tannic acid. This was possibly primitive. There were other primitive means of medicine going back a long way, but we hadn't got the Italians hadn't got in Africa the amount of drugs and the quality of drugs that were required, really, because of the obvious fact that the British Navy was seeking their convoys. Emmetine was used specifically to mean dysentery.
So you had a lot of trouble with the two types of dysentery.
Yes, we have two different wars, one with amoebic dysentery, and one with bacillary dysentery, specifically.
And what do you think was causing all this dysentery?
Obviously it was starvation, a lot to do with it. The learning of resistance of the human body of these men due to lack of food. That was just as it was. These men were being starved because they hadn't got anything to eat. Just the bare rations of the Italian ministry.
So it was that their resistance was weakened by starvation, and then what would actually bring the germs forward? I mean, were sanitary conditions not good as well?
There weren't. There was open latrines, the lack of antiseptics, the bacteria, not there.
So it was a combination of the two things. Plenty of germs and weak people.
That's right.
What other problems were common amongst the prisoners?
There's still a lot of these desert sores, especially with the older men and men who've been in the desert to some extent, who are suffering from lack of fresh fruit and vegetables.
And would the Italians have the range of treatments you'd employed before?
They had a great range of treatments, all in little glass tubes. Little glass phials which were given hypodermically, subcutaneously, which, in my considered opinion, and the considered opinion of many British doctors, were absolutely bloody useless. But anyway, they were admitted, that's the only thing you could do.
You didn't have your normal British cures?
No.
Any other problems that were common amongst the men?
No, I can't think there was anything else apart from the fact that they starved to death. The condition gradually grew worse. Later on, we moved to another hospital, Fortress of Zia, which had got a little more, which was a bit better equipped for medical than the Tahona.
Before we leave town, so you had the two wards. How many beds in each could you, roughly?
Possibly 20.
And that's for the district case. Any other wards for other cases?
Yes, for the non-malignant, non-infectious, like people who have been wounded, who are suffering from desert sores, they didn't want to be mixed up with the dysentery cases, and they were kept separately.
And there'd be two wards for one for the Italians, one for the...
Yes, but they were separate. Completely separate. Yes.
And you'd have an inspection room as well. Was it a whole block?
No, we didn't have an inspection room. Only they came in and they were put into the various wards. Eventually, there was several to the pneumonia. They eventually moved to the main hospital in Tripoli by ambulance.
And how long were you at Tahuna about?
How long was I in Tahuna?
About
a month, I think. Then I moved to Portus of Zia, hospital near Tripoli, which was better equipped. I was there until such times as the Battle of Al Alamein had taken place.
And do you remember much about your time there?
I remember one man who was comatose. He had, many of them had an injection of insulin. And this man, because of the lack of insulin in the secretions of the pancreas.
Through starvation?
That's right.
Malnutrition?
Malnutrition. And these men, after having an injection of insulin, were given massive doses of carbohydrates. In this particular instance, it was potatoes, mashed potatoes. But this man overnight, he was dying with insulin poisoning. There was no doctor present. The Italian doctor had gone. He lived apart from the hospital, and I thought the only thing to do was to give him a massive dose of glucose saline, which I picked up a stem, intravenous needle, sterilised the skin, put intravenous needle in, and gave him a glucose drip. I wasn't a doctor, but had I not have done this, the man would have died. And I did it, the man lived. That's a year. And the man, after the Italian doctor came in the morning, he was absolutely over the moon with what I'd done to save the man's life. And about a week later, the man was moved to Tripoli. He was conscious, rational. He shook me by the hand, and he knew my Christian name, and he said, "Thank you, Harry, for saving my life." That was one of three that did that. And that, to me, meant more than all the money in the world.
Now, you were getting on well with the Italian staff, were you?
Yes.
The doctors?
Yes. It was my job to get on well with the Italian doctors for the sake of the wounded and sick British prisoners of war.
And how in these early days, before you went to Italy, how did you feel about the competence of Italian doctors as compared to British MOs?
I thought they compared equally. I thought they were quite... some of their treatments of diseases were slightly different. I wouldn't say they were better. Their line of medical thought was somewhat different at that time.
But they were well-trained and competent.
They were well-trained, and they were very, very lean towards it. At times I did interpreting, I was asked to, in uncertain manner, especially one South African doctor, who said, "Don't tell him what you want to tell him, tell him what I tell you." He said, "These men, as you know, are not suffering from avitaminosis. They are being bloody starved to death." I said, "Yes, sir," and I told it, but I had to coot it in nice terms. It was absolutely important for me to maintain good diplomatic relations between the two sets of doctors, between Italian and British, South African, whoever I work with, doctors, for the sake of the sick and the wounded of the prisoner who I was helping to look after.
Now, what about this avitaminosia that you mentioned? What was that meant to be?
Lack of vitamin. Vitaminosis, lack of vitamins, lack of food,
and that was
starvation.
And that was the Italian's definition of
that
it.
That was the Italian's definition, vitaminosis, lack of vitamins.
And the South African preferred the more blunt malnutrition or starvation.
Well, as I say, I was coaching all the South African doctors' words. Tell this bloody man, these men want food, they don't want any of these bloody drugs in bottles and tubes, they want some good food. That was absolutely right. But where did they get it from when their convoy had been sunk by the British Navy? He explained to me in detail, the Italian way, said, "We haven't got enough troops. We haven't got enough food for our own troops. As soon as Montgomery gets here with his 8th Army and the Germans depart, then this will be a lot better. All these men can go back to the British Army." But it was wasn't the confliction between the two Italian and the South African or English doctors I was concerned with. My main concern was looking after, maintaining the wounded and the sick men that I was one of those responsible for. I got to think of those predominantly.
How many aides were there, medical orderlies were there, like yourself?
Me.
Just you?
Yes, at that time, me.
And the three doctors?
The three doctors was an Italian doctor, and a South African doctor named Warren. We had...
But even when you went to the second hospital near Tripoli,
yeah,
they still didn't have many doctors.
In Posidzia, yes, there was an Italian doctor with a goatee beard and grey hair, a very charming man.
So who actually looked after the wards with all the sick in? On your own?
Yes.
With no Italian?
No. Oh, I did have one or two what we call Italian piantonis who would do remove the doing sanitary work and cleaning the beds and cleaning the patients and so forth. People are suffering from dysentery and things like that. Of course, they fecated at all times, all places, and all that had to be cleaned up and burned. Of course,
that's what I was wondering about. Cause
yes, oh yes.
So they did that side of nursing.
In Africa, there were no other British orderlies present in that hospital, either to Tahuna or
So your job was medical rather than cleaning up side of nursing?
I helped, but I couldn't look after and clean all that lot as well. I mean, you need a staff. I mean, normally it's a staff of nurses for the day, don't you? And under nurses, whatever. I mean, yes, you need quite a few people to look after one person who is desperately sick as these men were.
And what was your living conditions at these Tahuna?
I slept in the ward with the patients. Slept in a bed in the ward with the patients. I was available to all the family.
So you were removed from the camp, in effect.
I was removed from the war camp. Yeah.
And
so
what?
Situated in the hospital.
What about your own food?
I ate with the same as the patients ate. We got better food. We got pasta and we got tagliatelle and we got. Minestrone, not much bread. We did get fruit, we got grapes, we got figs, we got dates.
So that's a much, much better diet.
Than the normal prisoner of war in a prison camp who were, you know, there was no food, very little food.
Were the men dying in the hospital, or were they mostly recovering, or were they sent somewhere else to die?
Those who died were sent away, of course, to the mortuary bed.
No, what I meant was, would they be sent to another hospital for more treatment before they died, or would they die in your hospital?
There were a lot sent as the time got on who didn't respond to treatment, who were sent to Tripoli. Some of them did respond to treatment, but it was very difficult because the condition of the men were such that it took more than the treatment of the drugs that we could supply. The treatment that we supply with the drugs available. So that's the way to put it. And we were waiting the arrival of the 8th Army, and of course the Italian doctors were all about, we can't understand, we've got nothing left at all. But then I was offered the chance of either staying at the hospital and being repatriated to the 8th Army when eventually they arrived, or being taken over, if this didn't occur, I'd be taken over on an Italian collier, and over the being sunk 10 to a dozen by the British Navy, or going over as a protected personnel on the Gdańska hospital boat, which was convoying sick and wounded from Tripoli to Caserta Military Hospital near Naples. My medical history sheet, my Cartella Clinica, was doctored by a chain that was inserted that I had got bacillary dysentery by the Italian doctor.
Now hang on, why did you choose that? Was it because it was an either or, Montgomery would rescue you or you'd be sent off on a collier and you weren't prepared to take the risk?
Had Montgomery arrived before we had, and the prisoner, the wounded and the sick man had arrived before there had any chance for the Italians or the Germans to remove these men, we would have been rehabilitated with the 8th Army. That, at that time, seemed very unlikely because it took quite a long time. And if Montgomery or the 8th Army hadn't arrived, the wounded and the sick would have been taken to hospital by that, but myself, not being wounded and not being sick, would have gone on Italian ship.
So hence you got this fake
chance of being sunk. It was probably a 99% chance that I would have been sunk.
So hence you got this certificate saying you had
a certificate which was made out by the Italian doctor, so I got the bacillary dysentery which I hadn't, and I was then transported onward to Gdańska along with German sick and wounded and Italian sick and wounded and British sick and wounded to Caserta Military Hospital.
And what conditions were the wounded transported in? I mean, was it overcrowded or was it?
No, it wasn't overcrowded. It was quite comfortable. I did a bit of work as an interpreter and an orderly on the boat, but no problem.
And now your Italian was coming along, I presume, apace at this.
Yes.
Were you fluent yet?
Adequate. For the occasions that I met, adequate. I come to defend the man in the law court.
Would it still be mainly medical and related language,
yes.
or could you socialise in
I could socialise. Yes, I could socialise.
Would you have an accent? An English accent, I mean, or...
Well, then, yes, I suppose so. Now, no. No, I've been taken many times.
But then...
No.
So what happened when you arrived?
Arrived at Caserta Military Hospital. And there were the two doctors that I'd worked with, Captain McFarlane, who had been wounded in the knee at Knightsbridge. Captain McPherson, who I'd worked with in Italian hospitals in Africa. And also Lieutenant Trippier, who has suffered this compound fracture of the humerus. And the humerus, but the arm had been saved. Because although he had a compound fracture of the humerus, there was a great deal of periosteum, the skin that surrounds the bone, left. And in that skin had grown a new bone. I remember I arrived in a convoy of ambulances, the green blackout lights were on in Naples, it was pouring with rain, went for that, and then in an ambulance to Caserta Military Hospital, I lay on the bed, and there was a person who said, oh, how are you? Okay. He said, look, I've got a pipe for you. I smoked a pipe. And McFarlane said, I can do better than that. I've got a pipe, I've got some tobacco, Red Cross parcel, caps and flake, and some matches. Do you remember this, young man? Hello, Sir Harry. That was Lieutenant Trippier. And I shook that man's hand, the same arm, the same hand that was due to be amputated, perfectly okay. It was then I was informed by these two Scottish doctors, and Scottish people don't, I suppose, not take much interest in cricket. They knew I did, but. Captain Hedley Verity of the Green Howards had died in Caserta Military Hospital. In all the books I've read, they say he was killed in Sicily. This is just a matter of conjecture, but they did tell me categorically that he had died in the Caserta Military Hospital.
And when had, do you know the month he'd arrived there?
The month would be January 43.
Now, one thing that we haven't covered is had your parents found out, or your father found out what had happened to you? I mean, because I think you were reported...
I was reported missing, believed killed. In the state of the defense was that there was a lot of blonde lads in the hospital. The kids came there, and the class of brothers came there, and dropped a few bombs on prison door. In the university, they didn't know.
This is during the march,
right? Yeah, that's right. And there was a lad there named Blondie Fowler who got killed. Of course, it went round the circuit. Blondie hit me. Who do you mean? Blondie, how are you there? He's blonde. Don't know, it could have been. And that's how it started. And then my father was officially notified that I was missing, believed killed. And he had that knowledge for some years until I... to arrive back to him that I was still alive in Italy.
And when would that be?
That would be toward the end of 44.
So for a long time he presumed you were dead?
That's true.
Did that cause a lot of distress in your family? I mean, it probably would, but I mean, or were they optimistic?
Yes, they were optimistic. My stepmother listened to from the radio from the Vatican City, who gave the numbers, the army numbers of prisoners of war who had been taken. These came over via the Red Cross at various intervals. And my army number was 903324, and eventually she didn't really find definitely out, but this number kept appearing, so she told me.
So the family found that was a comfort, and they presumed...
To some extent, comfort, but at that time, of course, the stress of war, they were resigned to the possibility.
And you hadn't been able to write or send one of those cards,
have you? We did, yes. We had letters to send through the Red Cross. To tell you the truth, I don't remember using them. It seems we always had much to do. And at that time, I'd forgotten what my father looked like. You know, my mother had died. I forgot what my father looked like. All I was thinking about was what I was doing at the time.
So what was the situation, Caserta Military Hospital? Were you joining the staff as an interpreter, medical orderly?
I left this ward where the doctors were, and we moved to another ward, right at the very bottom of the ward, away from the door. There was a man who was comatose, suffering from pneumonia. He was an English lad, he was doing the medical orders there, and I asked him, could I have some morphine, because I had already stated that it was believed in British medical circles that a small dose of morphine was highly beneficial in advanced stages of pneumonia. He remonstrated. Eventually I got some morphine and gave this boy a small amount. And he immediately became quite, because he was quite a disturbance to the rest of the patients. He immediately became more subdued. I raised him up, sat him upright, raised his legs as in a kneeling position before they're sitting, so to allow drainage, and he fell asleep, and he was perfectly all right for the rest of the night. In the morning, a little dapper Italian doctor appeared, and of course this English boy, the interpreter, went down with him. They got to the man in question, who was suffering from pneumonia, and he asked him, how does it feel today? And he said, well, what's been happening? Well, he said, overnight, a man down the bottom there gave him some morphine, of which the Italian flew up in the air. Who? Here. Well, I got it. He came down in a terrific rage. He said, get out of bed. Who are you? What are you? What do you mean by this? And so I explained that in the British School of Medicine, it was believed that a small dose of morphine was beneficial in advanced stages of pneumonia. To which he said, anch'io ho sentito. Also, I have read this. Let me look at your Cartella Clinica. He read my medical history sheet. He saw the doctor who had signed his name, the doctor who I'd worked with in Porto Cesare in Africa, near Tripoli. And he was a great friend of this particular Italian doctor. Whereupon the little dapper Italian doctor said, "Alzati, get out of bed, vieni con me, come with me." And I was set up again as an interpreter medical orderly.
So you'd been in bed, you were actually a patient when you treated this.
Supposedly suffering from similar dysentery, of course, which wasn't true.
But you were, as far as the doctor was concerned, interfering, because you weren't an accredited medical orderly.
But I knew that this was a good thing, and it did this man a power of good. He was much better.
And he survived.
And he survived.